Hello everyone, and welcome back to Murder, Mother and Me, where each week we will dive into some of the most infamous murders, mysteries and everything in between.
So if, like us, you are intrigued by all things true crime, you're in the right place.
I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your other host, Patty. I'm the mother.
And I'm the me. As always, thank you all for the support so far on the podcast.
Please follow, share with your friends and write us a review, but only if it's a good one.
Yeah, and also please follow us on Instagram. It is at Murder, Mother and Me podcast. We post everything that we talk about in all of our episodes on there for you to have a look at.
This week we are bringing you a case from 1995, and here are some interesting facts about that year.
Forrest Gump won an Oscar for the best picture. Starbucks released the Frappuccino for the first time. Christopher Reeve became paralysed from the neck down after falling from his horse.
That's really sad, isn't it? And it's also a bit ironic considering he was Superman. I've got another fact, can I add one on? Your sister, my daughter, Angel, was born in 1995.
That is an interesting fact.
And it's her birthday, coming up very shortly, so should we say it together?
Happy birthday, Angel.
Okay, everyone, let's get on with this week's episode. And this is the case of the unsolved disappearance of Jodie Huizentroot. In the early hours of June the 27th, 1995, Jodie Huizentroot, a 27-year-old news anchor in Mason City, Iowa, vanished without a trace. Evidence near her car suggested a violent struggle, but no witnesses or clear leads emerged. Nearly three decades later, her disappearance remains unsolved, leaving behind a haunting mystery that continues to baffle investigators and her loved ones alike. But before we go any further, let's go right back to the beginning. Jodie Sue Huizentroot was born on June the 5th, 1968, in Long Prairie, Minnesota. The youngest of three daughters, Jodie grew up in a close-knit family. Her mother, Imogen, and her late father, Maurice, instilled a love of adventure and hard work in their kids. Jodie was a high achiever. In high school, she excelled academically and athletically, leading her school's golf team to two state championships. Her outgoing personality and radiant smile made her beloved by her peers.
You don't often hear of young women playing golf, do you? I mean, it's not a very popular sport.
Well, I think, you know, we've got a golf club near to us and I see loads of old ladies going round, but not particularly any young ones. But I think it came from her father. I think her father died when she was fairly young, but I think it was in her teenage years, but she played golf with him, I believe, and he encouraged her to do so. Jodie carried that charisma with her into St. Cloud State University, where she majored in mass communications. It was there she found her passion for broadcast journalism. She interned at a local station and set her sights on becoming a news anchor, a goal she pursued with unrelenting determination. After graduation, Jodie began climbing the ladder of local television. She worked in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and Alexandria, Minnesota, before landing her job at KIMT-TV in Mason City in 1993. There, she anchored the morning news, delivering the day's top stories with her trademark enthusiasm.
Oh, so she was actually, like, fully on everyone's TV every day in the morning?
Yeah, I think it was, like, local to that area, so it wasn't, I don't think, national sort of thing. It was more to that area.
So she wasn't, like, a national news figure that people would recognise, necessarily?
Well, they were quite big areas, weren't they? I mean, you know, Iowa and Minnesota are huge states, aren't they?
So she would have been somewhat of a recognisable figure, I would say.
Yeah, she definitely would have been, especially to local people, and I think she was quite an ordinary kind of girl, really. You know, although she did this job, she carried on a normal life outside of the boundaries of the job.
Well, it also says her trademark enthusiasm as well, which tells me that she's quite recognizable for her style of telling the news or something. It might be a little quirky way of her doing things or something.
Yeah, I think she was full of personality and people just took to her. You know, she was what you want to see on the TV of a morning, bright and sort of peppy and sunshiny. To her viewers, Jodie was more than a journalist. She was a friend. Her bubbly on-screen personality and warm presence earned her a devoted following. But off-camera, Jodie faced the same struggles many young women encounter, balancing work, social life and concerns for her personal safety. Friends later revealed that Jodie had expressed unease in the weeks leading up to her disappearance. She mentioned feeling like she was being followed or watched, but she never went into detail. Tragically, these feelings were proved to be more than just paranoia.
I think that's one of the things, isn't it? When you're in the public eye, no matter how big or small the role is, you know, like you said, she's covering two big states, but still it's fairly small in comparison to the size of the United States. But when you're a figure on TV, regardless of how small the area is that you're covering, people are still going to recognise you out and about. It kind of makes you almost a bit of a target in a way, doesn't it? Especially if you're female.
Well, I think the key is in what we said before, that people recognised her and felt like she was their friend. So I'm guessing people wouldn't think twice about going up to her in public places and, you know, just chatting away to her or, you know, feeling like they knew her.
I wonder if she was actually being followed and that's what gave her that horrible feeling.
I think we'll discover later on that there was some credence to this idea in that she lodged a complaint with the police. In the early hours of June the 27th, 1995, her day began with an unusual delay. She typically arrived at the KIMT studio around 3:30 a.m. to prepare for the 6 a.m. broadcast. But by 4 a.m. she was nowhere to be seen.
3:30 a.m? That's bloody early, isn't it?
I wonder what time you'd go to bed to get up at 3:30 a.m. though.
Well, I also wonder what time you'd have to get up. That says she's arriving at work at 3:30.
Oh,
yeah. So that means she's probably up at least at 2:30 a.m. every day.
Yeah. I didn't think she lived too far away from the studio, but it was still a drive. But what? Imagine your sleep pattern, you wouldn't have one.
I know,
one,
I was going to say, that's quite a grueling schedule and time to keep getting up, isn't it?
And then to actually be there and go on air and look all bright and breezy.
Yeah.
God, I need 15 cups of coffee every morning just to wake me up. Concerned, her producer, Amy Coons, called her apartment. Jodie answered groggily, apologising for oversleeping. She assured Amy she'd be at the studio soon. That phone call, made at 4:10 a.m, would be the last known contact anyone had with her.
So far, it sounds like she's quite a reliable type of person. She is hardworking, enthusiastic. So, I don't know, is this... I'm guessing this is not a common occurrence that she's slept in.
I actually don't think this was the first time it had happened. It wasn't a regular occurrence, but I think from time to time, she did occasionally oversleep.
Okay, so it's not like a major red flag that she might have slept in a little bit?
No, not really, but it would be a red flag if they left her for any longer, because obviously she needed to be at the studio for a certain time to get to be on air at the correct time for the programme to go out. By 7 a.m, Jodie still hadn't arrived. Worried, her co-workers contacted the police. Officers went to Jodie's apartment complex, the Key Apartments, to check on her. What they found there was chilling. Jodie's red Mazda Miata was still parked outside, but the area around it told a disturbing story. Her personal belongings were scattered on the ground, a hairdryer, a can of hairspray, a pair of red high heels, and her car key, which was bent as if from a struggle. Police concluded that Jodie was likely ambushed as she walked to her car. Signs of a struggle, including drag marks in the gravel near her car, suggested she had fought back. Witnesses later reported hearing screams around 4:30 a.m, but no one called the police at the time.
Well, I mean, it's quite clear just from that description that something bad's happened.
Well, another thing about this is, where she exited her apartment, it was only 12 feet away from her car, so she literally had 12 feet to walk to her car, which is a very small distance.
Well, and that also says to me that someone's waiting for her.
Yeah, definitely.
That's not a chance encounter.
Doesn't sound like, does it? From the drag marks on the floor, I've seen the pictures. It was almost as if, you know, someone had, this is the way I interpret it, grabbed her from behind and pulled her along. You know, like the heels of her shoes or whatever was on her feet, scrape through the gravel, basically.
Well, and also, this is only 20 minutes later, if you go by the witnesses hearing the screams, after receiving the phone call from the office, let's say. It's only 20 minutes later, so not even that much time's passed, really.
The thing is, they were concerned enough to phone the police, weren't they?
Her co-workers, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a case of, oh, well, we'll just leave it, or someone else will do the job. I think someone did, her friend actually stood in for her, because obviously that programme's got to go out no matter what happens. But, you know, it wasn't like, oh, we'll just run down and check on her. They actually called the police.
Well, and like you said, it might have been a bit of a common occurrence sometimes for her to oversleep, but still make it into work on time and ready to broadcast. But for her to not actually turn up at all, I guess, raised major red flags.
I mean, to me, it looks like these personal belongings that were on the floor, and it says, you know, there was a hairdryer, can of hairspray. She was carrying her shoes, her actual shoes she would put on when she got there. Now, that's quite common for women to do that. I mean, you know, if you're going somewhere, you think, well, if I'm not going to wear the heels till later on, you're not going to trot round in them sort of thing. So she may have had like flat shoes on or lower heels on. And for them to be scattered on the floor, it indicates that she was carrying them, maybe not in a bag even. You know, she's just rushed out because she's late. She's grabbed what she needed to take with her. And someone within that 12 feet, that distance, has attacked her.
Well, and all the stuff that she's carrying, it makes sense with her job as well, like a hairdryer, hairspray, all that kind of stuff. Maybe the red heels were one she was going to put on to broadcast, like you said. So, it seems like she's just rushing out. Someone's grabbed her. And that's really all there is to it. But what I'm a bit baffled by is people reported hearing screams at 4:30 a.m., but none of them called the police.
Isn't that ridiculous? I've heard this in so many other cases as well. You know, 4:30 a.m. in the morning, it's probably still dark outside, isn't it? And you hear a young woman scream. Why would you not even, just as a precaution, phone the police?
Yeah, especially if, I mean, it doesn't actually say if these witnesses, you know, lived in the same complex or whether they were walking past or whatever. It doesn't say how they witnessed it. But let's say they lived in the same apartment complex. Surely you just have a peek out your window and just, if you're seeing, you know, the car door open with drag marks on the floor and that, doesn't take a genius to put two and two together, does it?
It's a bit of a sad world we live in, isn't it, when you can hear someone scream and just not even bother and just go back to sleep.
Just go back to bed, yeah. It also says witnesses, meaning more than one.
More than one. Yeah.
So the fact that there was more than one person that heard her scream and didn't call the police is a bit shocking to me, to be honest.
There's another case, actually, which I'll just mention here now. I'll need to look it up, but there was a similar case where a young woman got attacked and actually murdered, and there was 27 witnesses who all heard what was going on and all chose just to ignore it. But we'll come to that another time. The other thing about this, anyway, is this car key as well. It was bent, indicating to me that she put it into the lock. She got as far as a car, put the key in, and still had hold of it when someone's...
Yeah, so she'd almost started the car, pretty much.
Well, she'd almost got into a car.
I just can't shake the feeling that it feels to me like someone was waiting for the right moment to pounce and grab her. Like, you're not just going to be... I don't know, it could have been someone walking past or something, but I don't think, it feels more targeted than that.
It's highly unlikely. She was such a public figure, wasn't she? So it wouldn't be hard, really, for somebody to find out where she lived. I mean, I suppose if she was at the TV studios, somebody could park nearby and watch for a car coming out. She didn't really keep many things private, I don't think, so they probably knew what kind of car she had. They could follow her back to where she lived. She wasn't as safety conscious, maybe, as she should have been.
Well, especially back in 1995, things were a hell of a lot different than they are today. Maybe people were a little bit more trusting than they are now. I also just want to point out as well that this story so far is actually quite similar to the Susie Lamplugh case that we covered quite early on.
Oh, yeah, it is, isn't it? I mean, both young women, both sort of...
Both snatched from their job, almost, in a way.
Yeah, and both on public display, in a way, as well, because Susie sat in the estate agent's window, didn't she?
For everyone to see.
For everyone to see, yeah. As an attraction, really. And it's almost the same thing, because Josie was an attraction, wasn't she? Especially, like, going back all those years, they used attractive women, didn't they? You know, once you got to a certain age, you were no use anymore, really. But she was lovely, Josie, so that's, they made good use of her. And she was good at her job as well.
And it sounded like she was really well-liked by everyone.
Yeah, she had the personality to match, didn't she? From the evidence, it's believed that Josie was forcibly abducted and possibly shoved into a vehicle. But who could have done it and why? The answers have eluded investigators for nearly three decades. I think perhaps the saddest thing about this case is that the time that Josie's been missing actually outweighs the time she was alive. So she was 27 when she was abducted, and it's been best part of 30 years of her missing now, and we've still got no idea where she is. The investigation into Josie's disappearance was swift but challenging. Mason City Police, the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, and the FBI all became involved. From the outset, investigators faced a daunting task: finding leads in a case with no witnesses, no surveillance footage, and a limited crime scene. Police canvassed the area, interviewing neighbours and colleagues. They also searched local parks, rivers, and wooded areas for any sign of Josie or her abductor. But despite their efforts, no trace of Josie was found.
Do you think they might have ramped up the search a little bit faster than they would have if it was just a regular member of the public? And what I mean by that is, obviously, she was in the public eye, she was a bit of a figure on TV, stuff like that. So do you think that plays a part in how fast they look for someone?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, she was a local prominent figure, wasn't she? I think it's a case of, isn't it, partly, it's not what you know, but who you know. And I think it brought more spotlight onto the police as well, so they had to get on the case really quickly and appear to be doing a good job.
Well, yeah, because I guess even if you didn't know her personally, you feel like you know her through the TV, as we've discussed previously, so you're going to be thinking, hang on, where's that woman that normally does the news every day at 6 or whatever time it was?
Well, again, it's because people felt like they knew her. They would have a concern for her, wouldn't they, and be an interest in her. There was a vested interest in what she did, and this was big news, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that has to put a little bit more pressure on the police department, I guess.
There were probably some people, like, sort of emotionally attached to her, weren't they, in a way? They saw her every day. She was part of their household. So, you know, they wanted to see what happened to her, and they wanted to know she was safe. One of the most significant early leads came from Jodie's close friend, John Van Sice. Van Sice, a 49-year-old man, was one of the last people known to have seen Jodie before her disappearance. He claimed that just days before she vanished, Jodie had visited his home to watch a video of her recent birthday party.
That already sounds a bit strange to me, to be honest.
Well, I don't think it is, you know, because apparently they were really close.
To watch a birthday video?
Well, he'd thrown her a surprise birthday party, so, and obviously someone had taken a video of it, and maybe she'd not had time, or he tried to, you know, get it all together kind of thing.
And I guess back then, it wasn't a case of just airdrop it to your laptop and watch it. You'd have to put a videotape in the VHS, rewind it manually, probably with your fingers.
Or a pencil or something.
Yeah, get a hamster wheel going to get the telly on.
Yeah, treadle the electricity and all kinds just to do it. Yeah, so it was kind of a big thing, really, so we probably prepared it for us to see. And it wasn't unusual for them to visit each other because apparently they were really good friends, as I say. Van Sice cooperated fully with police, even taking a polygraph test, but his involvement raised eyebrows. Friends noticed that he appeared overly attached to Jodie, although there's no evidence that their relationship was anything more than platonic.
Do you think their relationship was more than platonic?
I think that it was, from his point of view.
I was going to say, maybe it's one-sided.
He wanted it to be, because he did strange things like... if anyone was talking to Jodie, he'd insert himself in the conversation and he watched her very closely. So to me, that's not a normal thing for someone who's just a platonic friend to do.
No, it's almost borderline, like, obsessive, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he was a good deal older than Jodie. She was 27 and I think he was about 20 years older. So was he 47?
He was 49, I think.
Or something like that, yeah. So, you know, that's a big age gap. So she probably, I'm guessing now, just off the top of my head here, but... her father died when she was in...
I was just going to say, I wonder if you're going to say that she's seen him as a father type of figure.
From her point of view, I think they played golf together and he had a boat actually that he named after Jodie as well, which is slightly strange. But people asked him why he did that. It was called the Jodie, you know, and he said, well, there's just not a more perfect name because she's, you know, because of her personality and everything. He
wanted. Well, basically saying because she's perfect.
Yes, really, yeah. So there's... there's that sort of theory, isn't there, you know, that maybe she looked at him at, like, that kind of figure in her life.
And obviously he was completely the opposite of that.
It sounds like it, doesn't it, to me, anyway? Yeah. Beyond Van Sice, police also looked into the possibility of a stalker. Jodie had told co-workers about a man who had made her feel uncomfortable. She once mentioned receiving an anonymous call at work and she believed someone had been following her. I think what it was she reported was it was something about a van, which is a little bit dire now, isn't it, when you think of what happened?
What, as in she reported thinking she was being followed by a van?
Yeah, to the police as well, so she obviously took that quite seriously.
Well, I mean, sometimes as well, you do get those little instincts, don't you, that, like, you're being watched or you're being looked at or, I don't know, someone's looking at you in a funny way or something, so I think you can never ignore those.
I think, though... you could be walking along through your day-to-day life and anybody could be following you that and you just don't know. I think with her as well, though, she had a set routine, which always makes it easier for an abduction, doesn't it? Because they can sort of set the clock, can't they, by what times you're going to be going into work and coming out.
And that's what it feels like to me has happened in this case. It feels like someone was waiting for her because they knew she was going to come out, you know, there about the same time every day.
And... what she did after she came out, you know, what her car was, where she went, where she lived, her routine was very familiar to them. But without a name or concrete details, investigators struggled to identify any suspects. And then there's the question of timing. Jodie's abduction occurred in a narrow window of opportunity between 4:10 a.m. and 4:30 a.m. Could her abductor have been lying in wait?
Yeah, I mean, that's literally exactly what I said before. again, it's such a small window of time, 20 minutes, it's really not that long. And like you said, the car was only 12 feet away from the door. You would have to know that. You'd have to know all these details. And it sounds to me like whoever has done this, they planned it. To me, there's no other option.
I think so too. I mean, the fact that she jumped up late obviously didn't deter them. They knew she was going to come out at some point. And as I say, there's been other times when she's been late for work. So somebody knew her well enough to know that she was going to be leaving her apartment at a certain time.
Well, and also I think just going back to her reporting this to the police about being followed and blah, blah, blah. It doesn't strike odd to me that they didn't have any names or anything, because I'm guessing she didn't know who she was being followed by. You know, if she's seen a van or something, I'm guessing she didn't take a license plate. She didn't do any of that, so...
It says here that she mentioned to colleagues in work that there was a man she was uncomfortable with.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that she knew who he was.
No, maybe not, but I just wondered about that then. Also, it could have been a case of when she's come out of the apartment, somebody she knew could have been standing by a car. It doesn't mean it was a total stranger. We're assuming someone jumped out on her. But actually, it could have been someone who she was familiar with that waited by a car, knowing she was going to go to a car. I mean, it's an outside chance, but it's still a possibility.
It's definitely a possibility. I think, yeah, we're just jumping to conclusions by saying someone's jumped out on her and surprised or whatever, but the drag marks don't necessarily mean it was someone she knew or didn't know.
Some of her friends said that she'd actually been in a relationship, a new relationship, or had seen somebody a few times just prior to this. So, for all we know, it could have been like a jilted lover kind of complex thing. You know, maybe she's told someone she doesn't want to see them. Obviously, that person would know her work schedule and has waited outside her apartment for her.
Well, I think, and also, you know, mentioning the fact that it might be someone she knew, it would kind of disarm her in a way, wouldn't it? Before they've even tried anything. Yeah. But then, would it not be slightly odd for someone you know to be standing by your car at 4:10 in the morning?
Yeah, it might be odd, but it doesn't mean that she would be afraid of them. She may be surprised to see them there.
Yeah, but alarm bells might not be ringing. I think also, if you walk out of your building at that time in the morning, you see potentially someone you know standing by your car and they're saying, oh, I've got a problem, or something. You know what I mean? Like, they're making it as if they need your help for something. Then you're not going to think, hang on, this is a bit dodgy.
I think it's more likely to be something like, if that was the scenario, somebody who she'd been seeing, you know, romantically, and she'd finished it, and then maybe wouldn't try to avoid them, or wouldn't take the calls, or has told him he won't take no for an answer, and then he's thinking, well, the only way I can actually see her is by turning up, and then she may come out and say, think, oh God, you know, but it wouldn't necessarily alarm her too much, and then it all goes, she may have tried to have a discussion, and it all goes the wrong way. It's just a possibility, isn't it, really? Over the years, several theories about Josie's disappearance have emerged. The most widely accepted is that she was abducted by someone who had been stalking her. Josie's career as a local news anchor made her a public figure, and it's not uncommon for journalists to attract obsessive admirers. Another theory is that Josie's abduction was a crime of opportunity. Perhaps her attacker was someone passing through Mason City who acted on impulse. This theory is supported by the lack of any known connection between Jodie and her potential abductor. And then there's the lingering suspicion around John Van Sice. While Van Sice was cooperative and has never been charged, his proximity to Jodie's life and his demeanour in the aftermath of her disappearance continue to raise questions.
For me personally, I'm going to go with option C so far. I think it's Mr. Van Slice. I mean Van Sice. I think it's John Cream Slice. I just think that's the most... It's the closest to home for her. It's the one that makes the most sense. I can't see it being someone that just passes through.
You know, usually when somebody's murdered, usually, obviously, there are opportunistic killers, but they always say, you know, if you draw a circle around that person, you know, it's those within that close sort of circle of friends and relatives that are more likely to have done it.
Well, I think also, you know, we've discussed the relationship that we think they had, and it kind of lends itself to him potentially wanting more than what they were, her not wanting it, and, you know, that usually leads people to do some crazy shit.
It's likely that it was him, but it could also equally, I think, have been some obsessive stalker. I'm kind of split between the two, to be honest, because although he looks like a likely suspect, it doesn't mean to say that he actually did it. It would have been very easy for somebody just some anonymous face in the crowd to find out where she lived and do the same thing.
Yeah, and weren't you telling me something about one of her friends that died or something as well?
Yeah, this is another sort of theory. It just goes off on a tangent, really. But Jodie had a friend called Billy Pruin, and he was very vocal about the drug scene that was rising within the area at that time. So he was found dead of a shotgun wound. It was originally ruled a suicide, but then they changed it to inconclusive. And none of his friends thought he committed suicide, so they're thinking maybe it was like a kind of drug connection that they silenced him, you know, because he was speaking out so freely about it. But then Jodie investigated his death. She was trying to do some investigation into it. And could then she have been silenced because of that? Because if it was there was a drug connection, did they not want her then going into that and making it awkward for them?
I mean, it's definitely a possibility, and, you know, journalists are known for digging probably a little bit too deep sometimes. And once you start stepping into that world, it's probably not a world that she was familiar with or knew much about.
She was probably ruffling some feathers, wasn't she? And that could have been an outcome from that.
I mean, that is just pure speculation, I guess. There's no evidence.
Well, there's no evidence, but there's no evidence for anything here. But, you know,
only evidence that we have is that she was abducted.
Yeah, those are the facts, you know. So she had a friend who died. All that what I said is true. But you can draw your own conclusions from this. Over the years, many searches have been conducted to find Jodie, but none have resulted in conclusive evidence pointing to a suspect. Jodie Huizentrout was declared legally dead in May 2001. In 2003, FindJodie.com was created by Minnesota television journalists Josh Benson and Gary Peterson, with the goal to keep the case in the spotlight and for the website to serve as a clearinghouse for tips that might lead to Jodie. One intriguing development came in 2018 when Mason City Police revealed they were re-examining hairs and fingerprints found at the crime scene using advanced DNA technology. Could this hold the key to solving the case? Unfortunately, no significant breakthroughs have been announced.
I mean, you would think in 2024 now, some of the amazing stuff they can do with technology, if they've got a fingerprint and they've got hairs, they must know more than what they're letting onto the public. They must do.
I think there's been an update on this just recently, and I think they've not said for sure, but I think it's the fingerprints. I think it's a palm print they found that isn't Jodie's, but there's a chance that the hair might be Jodie's, but they've not said that because they won't let anyone know exactly where they're up to with this sort of thing, for obvious reasons. You know, if there's a suspect, you know, they might go and sort of like, you can't change your hair, can you? But, you know, they're going to do everything to evade detection. The thing is, with the palm print or fingerprint or hair sample or whatever, the police can run it through a computer, but unless the person they're looking for has committed a crime before, they're not going to be able to match it up.
Or, you know, sometimes it's either they've committed the crime previously, or they've maybe submitted the DNA to Ancestry.com or something, you know, where you can find your family tree. That's usually, and actually quite recently, more criminals are being caught by submitting their DNA for things like Ancestry and stuff like that.
Yeah, I forgot about that, actually. So if they find the source of their nearest relative, they can actually pinpoint exactly where the DNA comes from, yeah. What makes Jodie's case so heartbreaking is the sheer lack of answers. Her family, friends and the community of Mason City have lived with uncertainty for nearly 30 years. Cases like Jodie's remind us of how fragile life can be and how the lack of resolution can haunt those left behind. Her disappearance has sparked conversations about personal safety, stalking, and the need for better protections for journalists and young women in the public eye everywhere.
So, are we both on the same page that we think that it was someone close to her?
I think it was someone who definitely knew her routine. I think that's fairly obvious. But whether it was someone...
But that's different to someone close to her, isn't it?
Well, they may feel like they were close to her. You know, isn't that the stalker mentality, that they think they actually know that person? But if you mean within a circle of friends, the obvious suspect here is John Van Sice. But I'm split between that and just a stalker that saw her on the TV.
I mean, you're right. It's a coin flip at this point, isn't it? But I just find it really bizarre and so tragic that in these cases, where is this person? Where is she?
I just want to say, though, before we go any further, John Van Sice, right? The reason I think it's unlikely to be him is because he had so many other opportunities to do this if he needed to. they've been together in her apartment, in his apartment. Why would he choose that 12-foot walk to a car to do this? When you
You don't know what's happened leading up to that morning, do you? So maybe the night before she's made a little comment to him or something and she's just flipped the switch in his head.
Yeah, maybe that's true. But, you know, the likelihood is if it was him, there was a more convenient way to do it, is what I'm saying. You're right, it doesn't, you know, it could have been an impromptu thing, couldn't it? You know, a spontaneous thing that happened. But when you think about it and weigh up all the odds, and the fact that he did take a lie detector test and was very forthcoming, you know, with details and things about their lives together, you know, as friends, and he did seem to think a lot of it, but I don't think I fully believe that it's him. I think it's more likely to be somebody else, if I'm honest, but I count a 50-50 on this one.
I think I'm pretty sold on Mr. Van Slice, to be honest. I keep calling him Van Slice, Custard, like a pasty.
His name's Custard Van Slice now.
Like a pasty from Greg's. A steak slice.
A flan.
Flan slice.
Can we just talk for a minute a bit about the
flan
names?
Slice. Flan slice. John Flan John Slice. Flan slice. Yeah, and just going back to it again, I just find it so bizarre how these people can actually just go missing and never be found. Like, she has to be somewhere, or she had to have been somewhere. Someone can't just disappear off the face of the earth. It's not possible.
No, but there's so many hiding places, especially in a country as big as America. You know, there's wastelands and things, isn't there, they could take them, the bodies to. But, I mean, obviously she was put into another vehicle, wasn't she?
Well, you would assume so. I think it's the quickest way to get rid of someone from a crime scene.
Well, I don't think you're going to plan to abduct someone, are you, with no tools or anything sort of thing and no exit plans. So I think she's walked to a car, somebody's grabbed her. That's evident from the drag marks across the floor. She's obviously, there was a bit of a struggle. She's dropped all her items she was taking into work. She's put her car key into the door to open it, and she still had hold of it when they've tried to pull her back, and it's bent it. So that was the force that was used. You know, she's resisted and tried to hold on, I think. And then she must have been put into another vehicle, but where she went from there, nobody knows.
I feel like I say this at the end of every episode, but
it's going to do your head
it's
in
gonna
now.
It literally is going to do my head in, because it's another one of those cases where, I mean, fingers crossed this new technology and the fingerprint that they found, or the hair or palm print or whatever it is, fingers crossed that does give some kind of resolution to the case, some kind of answers to the family. But as of now, it's anyone's guess, isn't it, still?
There's so many cases like this as well. You know, this is, the Maura Murray case that we covered as well. And they just don't get found, and it just... Don't you lie awake and think about it, though? I think of every scenario.
That's what I'm saying, though. You can't just disappear.
No, she's somewhere, isn't she? But we'll never know, I guess. Well, hopefully one day we will.
Can we also just address the fact that it took us about 45 minutes to an hour to just stop laughing at the names? Not actually the names of the people, but we've just gone off on a mad spiral for some reason.
Well, it's like every time I see a name, I don't know what comes over me. It turns into a different name in front of my eyes. And once I've got that name in my head, I can't get it out. So Josie's name, Josie Who's and Truth, started off as Josie Who's and Truth. Look, I'm doing it now. And then for some reason, it changed right before my eyes. Josie Who's and Trotter. Now, where did that come from?
Who's and Trotter. And then the more my mum kept saying Who's and Truth or Who's and Trotter, for some reason, then Truth ran with fruit in my head. So then I said, Josie Who's and Fruit. And then it turned to Jodie Frozen Fruit.
And then it changed to Jodie Opal Fruit.
And then we were thinking of a packet of Opal Fruit. And then for some reason it was a frozen blackberry. And we just went off on it. Just
I don't know.
And then
we went down a rabbit hole with that.
Then
one.
Obviously Mr. Van Slice came along. And then my mum saying John Van Slice. And then we went off on Cream Slice.
That was an accident though.
Yeah.
And then John Flan Slice.
No, it's ended up John Flan Slice. So it just
probably
takes...
Probably no one finds this funny but us. But
it just takes us so long to even say these names right, because obviously we're not being disrespectful to the victims or whoever else, but it's just our stupid sense of humour.
I've just got like a mental thing about it, and then when you say a name to me or a colour or whatever, you tell me something. You say a name to me, don't you? Any random object, and I think of something completely different. I might need to be looked at, to be honest.
Okay, everyone, that's it for another episode on Murder, Mother and Me.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next time.
And remember, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime.